we might get started. So, for those of you who don't know me, I'm Julian Savulescu. I'm the director of the Uehiro Centre of Practical Ethics, and we're coordinating a series of lectures within St Cross College, looking at the sort of expertise that we have in the area of applied ethics. And it's on that note a great pleasure to welcome Kathleen Sexsmith, who is in the second year of her MPhil in international development, and this is largely the results of her research in Mexico. So it's really great that we've got. I think you might be our first student presenting. So it's a good sign. We might get some more. So we normally have about an hour, and then we'll have the master has kindly put on some drinks. I think next door, and then we typically go for dinner. And I think we've booked for about six people at Al Shami, but I'm sure if any of you haven't kind of reserved a place, you'd be welcome to join us. Sadly, I can only pay for the speaker, but it's quite cheap. And we may be able to cover the wine.
Good. Well, thanks very much for that, and thank you all for coming. My thesis title is Power Relations in the Fair Trade Coffee Global Value Chain. So the presentation will proceed with an explanation of the fair trade system and what its goals are. Then I'll explain the theoretical framework I used in my approach to my thesis, which involved a reconception of power in the theory of global value chains. Then I'll explain the research methodology that I used in Chiapas this summer. And then I'll start explaining my results on the effects of fair trade on producers' ability to participate in the coordination of global value chains. And after that, I'll explain how I perceive fair trade to affect opportunities for producers to engage in functional upgrading, which means control of new processing and marketing activities along the value chain. And finally, I'll make some of my own personal recommendations for how I think the empowering potential of fair trade can be enhanced. So just to set to the context of how producers are exploited in the conventional global coffee trade, coffee is the world's second most important global commodity export, with an annual trade worth $9 billion. It is responsible for the livelihoods of 25 million smallholders in the developing world, and the conditions of coffee production largely require a tropical climate, so that's why it's primarily a developing world export. And it's primarily dependent on exports to developed countries. That's where the vast majority of consumption occurs. So I looked at the Human Development Index ranking of the top 10 producing countries, which is very low at 106 out of 177 countries. And the HDI ranking of the top 10 importing countries is 14.5, so just to provide sort of evidence of the structural flows of coffee. The coffee market used to be regulated by the International Coffee Organization between 1962 and 1989, and it functioned through an export quota system whereby producers had a real voice in the determination of prices. And these quotas were set in five-year targets, and the purpose was to reach a particular price range. And unfortunately, that system collapsed in 1989 as a result of neoliberal economic reforms throughout the world, and coffee has increasingly been priced in futures markets. And speculative activity is quite prevalent in futures markets. And as a result of this, the volatility of the coffee price has increased dramatically, and there's also been a dramatic influx of coffee on the market after the export quota system collapsed. So just looking at some International Coffee Organization data on the prices received by Mexican growers, this actually doubled the variation of the price after 1989 when the price collapsed. And the real price of globally traded coffee declined by 50%. So there truly is a coffee crisis in the world right now. In this context, roasters such as Nestle and Sara Lee and Kraft have become increasingly concentrated, and they've used their market power to squeeze producer profit margins. So, for example, between 1995 and 2001, the price of green coffee beans, or unprocessed coffee beans, fell by 66%, but at the same time, the retail prices of processed beans fell by only 23%. So this shows that there's been a real transfer of surplus from the south to the north. So it was in this context that the fair trade coffee system emerged. It's really been a movement that's been growing over the latter half of the 20th century, embodied in the various commodity agreements of the 1960s and 1970s. And became an institutionalized system in 1989 when a Mexican coffee producers cooperative called UCITI approached a Dutch NGO and requested that this fair trading that they had been engaging in on a more informal basis became a certified process so that they could actually reach mainstream markets with their certified product. So the system has grown since then, and in 1997, there were so many different labeling initiatives in importing countries and a lot of disconnection in the system that they decided to create Fair Trade Labeling Organizations International. And it's under FLO that the rules for a variety of fair trade products are set, which determines which producer groups can participate and which buyers can participate in the system. And in the early 2000s, they created an independent arm called FLO Cert, which is responsible for the monitoring and enforcement of certification. So essentially, the purpose of this system is to restructure the very exploitative pricing mechanisms that exist in the conventional market. And these rules are set in conjunction by FLO and the labeling initiatives in the respective importing country. So producer cooperatives, in order to attain and maintain their fair trade certification, must prove that they're democratically organized and controlled by their members. They must demonstrate that they have export capacity, existing demand for their product, and are financially sound. They must prove that they have environmentally sustainable practices, and that they are promoting economic and social development among their members. And on the buyer side, they must prove in all their contracts that they have paid a certain minimum price, and that's currently $1.21 per pound, which is going to be increasing to $1.25 per pound next month. But they also pay a premium for social development, which is now at 10 cents per pound. And with that money, the producers make democratic decisions about their development priorities within the cooperative, and they invest in wherever they feel the need to be the greatest. And the buyers must also provide 60% pre-financing for the contract if it is requested by the producers. And finally, they commit to a long-term relationship with these producers. So the research questions that I attempted to answer through my fieldwork was, first, does fair trade empower producers to participate in the coordination of value chain? Does it empower them to gain control of new processing and marketing activities along the value chain? And finally, what are the local political structures and gendered social structures that may undermine the potential of fair trade to have a true impact? So just to briefly describe global value chain theory, it's been popularized since the mid-1990s, but the most common definition is a network of labor and production processes whose end result is a finished commodity. So global value chain theorists have a structural perspective on the world economy, and they perceive power not simply in quantitative terms of market control, but in the ways that power is exercised by multinational corporations over developing country producers. So it's manifest in the control of the value chain and the setting of the terms of participation in the value chain. So all value chains are characterized by a governance pattern, which involves the setting and the enforcement of these parameters for participating in the chain. And there are also various opportunities for upgrading within a value chain that are usually made through investments by the value chain governor. So some forms of upgrading do not involve advancements along the chain, and those are called product or process upgrading. But other forms of upgrading, called functional upgrading, basically means that they have generated the rents required to participate in new value-added activities. So in my review of the literature on global value chain theory, it seemed to me that there was a paradox where it was necessary for producers to participate in a tightly governed value chain in order to achieve functional upgrading, because governors needed to make the investments for them to engage in this process. But at the same time, governors don't have an incentive to hand over chain control to producers. Their incentive is to maintain chain control. So it seems that there's a paradox where producers' empowerment is essentially limited, and it's impossible for them to gain the position of chain governor. But other writers from economic philosophy have suggested that power in economics is not necessarily only exercised to the detriment of weak agents, but also maybe exercised to the benefit of weak agents at the expense of their own power. And that's how I perceive fair trade, as a means of promoting producer participation in governance by encouraging governors to actually hand over a share of their control over the value chain to producers. So to undertake this research, I went to Chiapas, Mexico in August and September of 2007, and I stayed for 9 weeks. And I was able to do a case study of a producers' organization called La Selva, and they've been in existence since 1979 and are very well known in the area. And they were involved in the very first certified fair trade exchange that occurred in 1989, so they have a long history with the system. They were actually excluded from fair trade in the early 2000s, and that was a result of some suspicions surrounding the honesty of the leadership of the cooperative and some financial problems. And it was quite obvious to me during my fieldwork that these problems of dishonesty might remain. But as my time was limited, I kept to my case study and did my best to contextualize the study with interviews with other cooperatives, as well as representatives of local government who had experiences with other fair trade groups. Two importers, so one is a current importer of La Selva's, and one is a past importer, and that's Twin Trading of London. And then I also interviewed two representatives from labeling initiatives, one in the UK and one in the US, at Transfer USA. So I applied a variety of quantitative and qualitative tools to my research, which I will demonstrate later on. And it was a very key concern of mine to include as many women as men in the research, because I suspected that women's experiences of fair trade would be far different from men's. So I ended up with about 112 respondents, and slightly over half of those were women. So the first research question is the extent to which producers are empowered to participate in the coordination of value chain activities by fair trade. So the first dimension that I looked at was the distributional outcome of participation in fair trade and a comparison to conventional value chains. And what I found was that there is a limited redistribution of income and value added towards producers in fair trade, but that is truly not a substantial redistribution. So you can see that the farmer's share doubled to about 8% of the value added made available by the sale of the coffee. And the cooperative gained 6%, which leaves about 15% in total at the farmer level, compared to 4% in the conventional system. And also in the conventional value chain, it's truly dominated by the roasters, who gain 71% of all value added. And in the fair trade system, this is distributed between importers, roasters, and retailers. But you can still see that the importer retains a significant share of the value added, and this is concentrated in northern countries. In terms of the distribution of profits along the value chain, in the conventional chain, these are also concentrated among roasters, and Nestle is very secretive about its profits, but some have estimated that its profit rate is approximately 25 to 30%. And at the same time, the real price of coffee has often fallen below the cost of production for Mexican farmers, so it's not a sustainable livelihood activity. In the fair trade value chain, the profit rate of the importer stays high at 20%. And I analyzed 7 cases of very closely of household budgets to determine how profitable coffee production was for them. And for 3 of the 7 families, coffee was not profitable. But that was when I was valuing the family labor at the market rate. So if you do not include the market valuation of labor, it's unprofitable for 1 of the 7. And also I found that the income earned purely from coffee sales was insufficient to sustain basic household budgets for 4 of the families. Another aspect of governance I looked at was the terms of fair trade contracts. So these are signed at the beginning of the harvest season with the fair trade buyers, and they're typically closed contracts. So that means that when the international price of coffee rises, the producers are locked into the fair trade minimum price. And this creates a disincentive for fair trade producers to actually sell to the cooperative, because the local intermediary is often offering a price just as high, if not higher, than the cooperative, because he doesn't have all the administrative costs related to the democratic organization of the cooperative. And also, he'll agree to purchase 100% of the output of producers, whereas fair trade cooperatives are restricted to the highest quality output. So, for example, in two of the regions I visited, farmers were being offered 22 pesos per kilo for their coffee from the local intermediary when the cooperative was only offering 20. So it was a severe problem. Another implication of the contracts is related to pre-financing. And essentially, the worthiness of producer groups to receive financing is determined by conventional risk assessment frameworks. And it's not determined by the concern to restore the creditworthiness of producer groups. So a group like La Selva, which has had some financial problems, is not receiving pre-financing from its clients. And in that case, this re-enhances the cycle of uncreditworthiness of the producer group rather than ameliorating the problem. In terms of the enforcement of flow rules, it's quite obvious that the burden of adjustment is entirely on producers. They have their entire business process monitored, whereas the buyer is only monitored for its compliance with a set of rules relating to the flow of a single product. So in that situation, buyers have the opportunity to take advantage of cooperatives in their contracts that are made outside the fair trade system. So for example, one of La Selva's clients increased its purchases substantially from the group over a four-year period and eventually accounted for half of all of their exports. But at the same time, they were decreasing the amount of coffee that they were buying from fair trade. So as the cooperative's dependence increased, they were actually reducing the total price that they were paying for the coffee. And at the end, their price was the lowest of all the export clients that La Selva had, including the non-fair trade clients. In terms of the extent to which producers are represented in the governing bodies of fair trade organizations, there are some very unique and interesting cases among importers where producers are made full members of the organization and have full decision-making roles, such as in Twin Trading in London. There are literally no constraints on the number of producers that can be elected to the board of the organization, so they participate quite actively. In terms of producers' representation among governing structures within fair trade organizations, such as FLO, it's extremely limited. For example, there's 23 seats on the governing body of FLO, and 20 of these are represented by individual importing countries. And there are three producer seats that are kept for the regional producer representative bodies. So there's one from Africa, and there's one from Asia, and there's one from Latin America. So there's a huge asymmetry in representation there. And I was fortunate to interview one of the former representatives for the Latin American and Caribbean regions, and he described this as totally insufficient and unjust, and that it gave him the opportunity to fight for things like the increase in the minimum price, but not to vote on these decisions. So they are effectively excluded from decisions. Yeah. Another purpose of the fair trade system is to encourage flows of information, not only from producers towards importers, but the other way around. So I sought to understand whether fair trade was truly recognized by producers and if they conceived it as something more than a minimum price or a commercial strategy. So 14% of the male producers I asked were unable to identify any purpose of the system beyond a commercial strategy that provided a higher price. And fully 20% were unable to describe the term. And when I interviewed women, nearly 100% could not explain the meaning of fair trade. And then when I was also asking producers if they understood the processing procedures for their coffee and the final destination for it, the majority also could not identify more than one country where the coffee was sold or whether it was sold in supermarkets or cafes. And the ones who could identify this were founding members of the producer group, or they were community delegates, so they had better access to information, and this was not being distributed. And a final aspect of governance is the sanctioning that is imposed for the failure to comply with fair trade rules. So within the flow system, there are a number of incentives for importers to comply with the rules, such as punctual reporting, for which they receive a discount on their certification fees. But there are no performance incentives for producer groups. As well, producers are charged a flat fee to participate in the fair trade market, and that's irrespective of the quantity of coffee they can actually sell on the fair trade market. So in a number of cases, they actually don't achieve any fair trade contracts, but are forced to pay these exorbitant certification fees in euros. And on the other hand, buyers are charged a per pound fee by their national labeling initiatives. So as a result of that, they can obtain the reputational advantages of fair trade while importing a very small quantity of fair trade coffee and incurring very low costs for having done so. And finally, importers have the right to include in their contracts clauses that say they will fine the producers in the case that the quality of the shipment doesn't match the quality of the pre-shipment sample. So this had happened to two of the cooperatives that I interviewed and was up to 13% of the contract value, the discount that was eventually made. So it's not to say that producers should be allowed to give coffee of poorer quality. The problem is that there's no formal appeal process that these producers can engage with in order to prove whether or not this fine was merited. And there's also no reciprocal mechanism such that if, for example, the importer was not providing the pre-financing as promised, that the producer can make a complaint about this. So it's a very asymmetrical system in that sense. So the next research question was whether fair trade empowers producers to generate rents, and whether the rents that are generated enable them to control new processing and marketing activities along the value chain. So the first rent that I perceived fair trade might help producers to create is technology rents. And I looked at specifically whether organic production is a financial advantage to producers in the sense of increasing the income-cost ratio for them. And from my analysis, there was some conflicting evidence. I relied on production data from a statewide coffee-producing agency, which had interviewed about 85% of the producers in the region. And I used the prices that the cooperative offered for the organic and non-organic coffee. And I found that for the statewide producers, the income cost ratio was, in fact, beneficial for organic production. But for traditional, certain regions within Chiapas, the cost of labor was so high that the income cost ratio was actually less beneficial for organic production. And that's because organic requires a significant amount of labor that traditional coffee production doesn't require, and the daily wage is increasing rapidly in southern Mexico because of migration to other provinces and to the U.S. And the value of organic production as a rent is also diminished by the fact that many fair trade buyers have the option to purchase organic quality coffee with its higher production costs under conventional terms. So rather than pay the 15 cent per pound premium for organic coffee, they pay the conventional price. And this is problematic because the majority of fair trade coffee is the highest quality the cooperative can produce, and that will be the organic output. Another rent I looked at was human resource and organizational rents. So the question was, does fair trade help cooperatives to improve their average skill level, and do these improvements in the skill level translate into organizational innovations? So at the cooperative level, most of the people I interviewed said to me that it did in fact enhance their administrative skills and their organizational capabilities. But the problem within the fair trade system is that it tends to favor those who are already most advanced. Because there is a great proliferation of producer groups over recent years, it tends to be those that are already the most commercially sound that are able to achieve the fair trade contracts. And others have criticized the fair trade system on the grounds that only the relatively better off producers are able to organize into cooperatives, whereas those with the greatest level of poverty are unable to even organize democratically, and they're not even able to access the system. And finally, some of the importers expressed that the requirements of flow that producers are democratic in structure and make all decisions through a general assembly and turn over their leadership regularly was actually reducing their ability to make commercial relationships with these producers because they were so slow in their decision making. And within the household, fair trade has certainly had positive impacts on the development of literacy and financial skills among the wives of LaSalva members, and that's through a flow recommendation that the cooperative set up a women's group called MUSA. And in this group, they participate in all sorts of literacy projects or small gardening projects. They also have corn mills and coffee mills and small bread shops that they actually are able to generate their own resources for themselves. And this is all thanks to a flow recommendation. And as a result of this, they expressed that compared to their counterparts within their communities, they were being granted more independence. It was easier for them to go into town, whereas other women would simply be told by their husbands that they are to stay at home and didn't have the right to leave the house. The unfortunate thing is that participation in this women's group is very limited, and only 12% of the wives of LaSalva members belong to the organization. And within the group, there's also a lot of sort of political tensions where the founding communities are receiving the vast majority of the resources, and those that are further away from the head offices or that joined more recently are not receiving many projects, and they express a high level of dissatisfaction about this. And finally, the creation of MUSA, while being certainly an empowering thing, has also relegated the women to a very distinct space that they perceive to be their own, and it's very separate from the decision-making procedures within the cooperative. So they maintain without any control over the commercial decisions or without the capacity to participate in the coordination of the value chain. Another form of rent is that of relational rents, and these exist on three levels. The first is vertical relationships, so essentially that implies that the producers have closer and tighter relationships along their value chain. And fair trade certainly has positive impacts in this area, since it eliminates the local intermediaries that are often very exploitative. And these buyers have also demonstrated in interviews the intent to establish long-term commercial partnerships with the producers. And there's been a beneficial impact coming off of this, which is that close relationships of buyers have fostered horizontal cooperation amongst cooperatives within Chiapas. So, for example, Twin Trading of London has made significant investments in building up the capacity of producer groups in the region by bringing them together in an exporting project, and also a project called Café Palenque. Maybe you've seen the coffee in the Oxfam stores, but it's a branded product where producers have participated in the decisions concerning the blending, and the origin of the coffee is signaled on the package, as well as a photograph of some of the producers involved in the project. So it really serves to bring the producer to the consumer. But the person in charge of this project, whom I interviewed in London, commented to me that the selection of the groups that would benefit from this project was highly political, because the four founding cooperatives wanted to keep the project benefits to themselves, and they didn't want to share with a number of other cooperatives who had been involved previously. So this may foster competition among groups more than it fosters solidarity. And finally, institutional rents exist when producers are enabled to participate in policy making or to sway policy to their favor. And someone I interviewed who was involved in the state-level coffee agency commented to me that fair trade has helped produce or prove the commercial soundness of cooperatives, and to that extent they have been taken into consideration much more in coffee policy in the state than they were previously, when it was dominated by the plantations. Another kind of rent is financial rents. So my question was whether fair trade affects the ability of producer groups to gain access to external sources of financing and to generate internal funds. And this is particularly important in the context of coffee, because if the producer group does not have access to financing and it can't pay the producers for their product when they deliver it, that really undermines the organization. Producers will be swayed to sell to the local intermediary instead. So fair trade attempts to resolve this problem by providing pre-financing. So as I said, the effectiveness of fair trade is quite, of pre-financing is quite limited. But there have been some very positive cases. For example, one of the importers told me that he had taken out a second mortgage on his home in the U.S. so that they could provide pre-financing to a cooperative. But in other cases, there's certainly not a main concern. However, it is compensated to some extent by the social premium, which is paid as a separate payment from the overall coffee contract. So La Selva, because it was not receiving pre-financing, it used its social premium as a liquid guarantee so that it could obtain access to 50 million pesos in lines of credit from a local social development bank. And with that money, it was able to pay its producers on time and ensure their loyalty to the organization. As well, I think that the indirect effects of fair trade on the organizational cohesion and the reputation of cooperatives has helped them to develop an organization they now have called Fondo Selva, and that's a microcredit scheme where producers can obtain access to up to 10,000 pesos in lines of credit, and so far there's over 300 families who have benefited from that scheme. Another kind of rent is related to the marketing and design of the coffee, and I was concerned with whether the price premiums that consumers pay in the northern markets is distributed towards producers. So I did find in some cases of the importers that I spoke with that they had developed particularly close vertical relationships with producers and were actually allowing them to use their logos and their marketing strategies in the domestic market. And they were sharing, in some sense, the development of these strategies with producers. But on the other hand, some of the producers who were not enabled to participate in these kinds of projects just felt that the fair trade system was so oversaturated with cooperatives that there's not much more of a reputational advantage to being involved in the system. And finally, value chain theorists encourage analysts to search for an nth rent, by which they essentially mean what unique rents can be generated for producers. And so I considered whether the non-conventional pricing mechanisms of fair trade might constitute what I might call a solidarity rent, which would essentially guarantee that coffee is a sustainable livelihood activity for producers. So in my analysis of the seven producer families, I found that when I was not valuing their labor at the market rate, they earn profits between 50 to 90 pesos a day in the coffee plot, so that's equivalent to approximately $5 to $9. But unfortunately, the opportunity cost of coffee production was exceeded in some of those cases by the profits that could be earned from corn production, because corn is a staple to the Central American and Mexican diet, and that's the second largest or second most important crop after coffee for these farmers. And with the likely to be coming increases in the corn price, the opportunity cost will probably increase for these farmers. And the reasons for which I think fair trade might have failed to ensure a sustainable and profitable livelihood for these farmers are threefold. One is that the fair trade minimum price has remained constant in nominal terms since 1989. So a study that I read of the comparison of the price in real terms shows that it's declined from about $1.41 to 90 cents in 1992. So it's completely unadjusted for local cost of production or increases in cost of living. A second problem is the fact that, as I mentioned, fair trade sales usually represent a very small portion of the overall exports of cooperatives. So if in my case study it was about two-thirds of their exports, but the average for Mexican cooperatives is about 20%. And finally, the fair trade pricing system is not completely outside the conventional market. So when the market price rises to the minimum, it then follows the market. And this basically eliminates the financial benefits of fair trade. So, for example, the local clients of La Selva who purchased the export quality beans were paying a higher price than the fair trade minimum. So, in conclusion, I do feel that fair trade redistributes some of the coffee chain value added and income towards producers, and in some cases has created opportunities for them to participate in the governance of the value chain. But I feel that power continues to be skewed towards northern corporations, and it's not consistently exercised in beneficial ways towards producers. In terms of the opportunities that are created for functional upgrading, these do occur in the sense of fostering the organizational cohesion of the group, entering into new financing activities, processing activities, and marketing and design activities, and these are very positive. But the empowering potential of these changes is limited by the fact that power is distributed unequally within households and between cooperatives. So what I would recommend, I'm sure Flo is not listening too closely to me, but if they were to listen, I would recommend that the inspectors should provide more active assistance to cooperatives to help them meet the terms of participation, and that they take a stronger stance on gender discrimination and make stronger policies relating to the degree to which women must participate in policies and decision-making within the cooperative. And I also think that the minimum price should not be tied to the market, and I feel that it should rise at a constant proportion once it reaches the market rather than stay tied to it, so that producers don't have a disincentive to remain loyal to their cooperative. That's it.